Today is Monday, June 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up. U.S. President Donald Trump and First Lady Melania Trump received a 41-gun salute to welcome them to Buckingham Palace today. Also ahead, Acting Defense Secretary Pat Shanahan says his top concern is China, and at least 9 people are dead and several injured as Sudanese government troops attempt to disperse a sit-in protest in central Khartoum. It's all on today's International Edition. Since the first day Acting Defense Secretary Pat Shanahan took the reins at the Pentagon, he said his top concern is China, China, China. And in his first major appearance in Asia as the U.S. military civilian chief, he did not shy away from criticizing Beijing's bad behavior. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has more from Singapore.
Acting Defense Secretary Pat Shanahan was all smiles ahead of a meeting with his Chinese counterpart that focused on building relations. But speaking to an audience at the annual Shangri-La Defense Forum, Shanahan said the U.S. would not ignore Chinese behavior, which he says has threatened prosperity in the region.
It's not about conflict. It's not about building walls. This is about security.
China is infamous for its theft of other nations' military and civilian technology.
I don't like when intellectual property is stolen. We have real issues with intellectual property theft, cyber attacks. There's a host of issues that we have to address.
Experts say China has used this theft to narrow the gap between some critical American and Chinese military abilities. Michael O'Hanlon is a defense analyst with the Brookings Institution.
The kind of advantage that we had against China in the Western Pacific during the Cold War is gone for good.
And China has continued to project more military power beyond its borders, most notably by constructing artificial islands in the South China Sea and placing heavy weapons on them to support territorial claims not recognized under international law.
They argue that it's defensive. It looks like it's a bit overkill.
Recently, the U.S. has pushed for more international patrols in the South China Sea, including one last month with Japan, India, and the Philippines. Bradley Bowman is with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies.
I think we need to do more of that because I think we need to characterize this conflict for what it is. It's not a conflict between China and the U.S. It's a conflict between China and the world.
U.S. allies here in Singapore were increasingly anxious over rising tensions between the two powers. And as one leader pointed out, many believe China and the U.S. need to work together, or they risk upending the global system. Carla Babb, VOA News, Singapore.
Among the top stories in the world, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo voices skepticism about the process for the Trump administration's long-delayed Israeli-Palestinian peace plan, even before it is disclosed. NATO is ready to welcome North Macedonia as its 30th member after the country ended a decades-long dispute with Greece. And officials in Afghanistan say a powerful bomb ripped through a minibus carrying government employees in Kabul today, killing at least 5 people and injuring 10 others. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
Did you know that you have a built-in network of biological clocks, which over a roughly 24-hour cycle regulates a variety of processes such as behavior, physiology, and metabolism? This system of clocks is usually synchronized with our body's master clock located within the brain's hypothalamus. Scientists have suspected that these individual clocks can operate independently of the master clock. To test this theory, researchers from Spain and the U.S. stopped the circadian system system of specially bred mice. Then they activated individual clocks in the liver. While all the other clocks had been disabled, the researchers found that the liver continued to keep its circadian rhythm and performed its critical functions. The researchers say that their work could help scientists learn more about circadian rhythms, the aging processes, and a person's general well-being. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Well, U.S. President Donald Trump is in Britain for a visit that includes meeting with the royal family, a state dinner, and talks with outgoing Prime Minister Theresa May. Britain's Queen Elizabeth greeted Trump and his wife Meliana after they arrived at Buckingham Palace by Marine One helicopter today. After welcoming the ceremony that included a 41-gun salute and inspection of the Royal Guard of Honor, the Trumps headed inside for a private lunch with the Queen. The Queen gave the President and the First Lady a tour of the picture gallery of the Buckingham Palace. The artifacts on display include an 18th-century map of New York and a pewter horse statuette that the President gave Queen Elizabeth on his working visit last year. Before leaving Washington, Trump said his trip would be very interesting and that he thinks the United States and Britain have an opportunity to work out a very big trade deal in the near future.
Officials have talked about it, and they have put it in the context of the need to maintain stability, as the Secretary of Defense, Wei, did in Singapore. It's not something they'd like to refer to, but in his case, he was asked a question, and he replied.
Will any of this, that information...
And VOA's International Edition continues. Well, China's defense minister defended the country's deadly crackdown 30 years ago on pro-democracy protesters in Beijing's Tiananmen Square, saying it was the correct policy. China's validation of the brutal treatment of the protesters was a rare acknowledgment of the June 4, 1989 incident that occurred after 7 weeks of demonstrations. Students and workers were demanding democratic change and the end of corruption when government soldiers and tanks chased and killed hundreds of protesters, possibly more than 1,000, although the exact number of deaths remains unknown. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke to Orville Schell, director of U.S.-China relations at the Asia Society, asking if other Chinese officials had talked about what happened 30 years ago in Beijing.
Officials have talked about it, and they have put it in the context of the need to maintain stability, as the Secretary of Defense, Wei, did in Singapore. It's not something they'd like to refer to, but in his case, he was asked a question, and he replied.
Will any of this, that information or that question reach the ears of Chinese people?
I would think that that particular exchange would not.
Why do you think he decided to answer the question if he knew that the government was taking such a hard stand against dissemination of such information?
Well, I suspect what happened was that he gave a speech and then was scheduled to answer questions, and that was the first question that popped up. I don't think that he chose it, but he couldn't eschew answering it, I think, once it was posed.
All right, now, this is the 30th anniversary coming up of Tiananmen Square. Do you expect any changes whatsoever in the future from the Chinese government as to how it communicates what happened or did not?
No, I think that the Chinese Communist Party is dedicated to erasing this particular incident. It was embarrassing, and it was very unsettling from the historical record to the best of their ability.
I'm seeing this in your mind as not the biggest story in the world, right?
Well, I think the story is the real tragedy of June 4th was not simply the bloodshed, but that it ended China's ability to feel comfortable with any kinds of political reform. And we are seeing the consequences of that continuing to play out today.
Do you think that Xi Jinping has healed any situation whatsoever or made it worse?
I think he tends to be more dependent on control than some of his predecessors, and I think he is more of a Leninist than either Hu Jintao or Jiang Zemin, who preceded him.
That was Orville Schell, director of U.S.-China relations at the Asia Society, speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. Well, Sudanese government troops appear to have attempted to break up a sit-in protest near the defense ministry in central Khartoum with deadly results today. Sudanese medical sources and doctors supporting the opposition say at least 9 people have been killed in clashes. The French news agency reports at least 13 have been killed. Sudanese security forces moved on the protest area today. Reports say machine gunfire and explosions were heard. Reuters noted a report from Sky News Arabia TV saying that a Sudanese military spokesman described the raid as targeting criminals near the protest site, but not the protesters. A group representing the protesters has been negotiating with the ruling Transitional Military Council since the ouster of longtime leader President Omar al-Bashir on April 11th after weeks of protest over a sharp increase in the price of basic products. The negotiations between the military and protesters broke off. However, the sides could not reach an agreement on who will lead a transitional authority until elections can take place. Protesters are demanding that civilians lead any transitional body. VOA reports that the military said talks between the sides are expected to restart today or tomorrow, but opposition groups have said talks are not possible and have called for a halt to all negotiations with the military. This is VOA's International Edition.
Hello, it's the weekend. You deserve something special, and I've got just the thing. A spicy, sweet platter of the best Pan-African music on earth. This weekend, you'll hear an exclusive interview with Kagwe Mungai from Kenya.
My name is Kagwe Mungai. I am, as you've said, a singer-songwriter. I'd like to call myself an entertainer.
Wonderful old and new tunes from 10 different countries, including the official 2019 Africa World Cup theme song. And Song of the Week with Kwame Ofori is Oh My Love by Zambian sister duo Da Vows. So spice it and sweeten it up with me, Heather Maxwell, on Music Time in Africa. This Sunday and the following Saturday at 15 and 20.500 UTC.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. The International Air Transport Association, IATA, is urging a carefully coordinated release of new software for the Boeing 737 MAX passenger jet. The IATA, which represents about 290 airlines, is meeting in Seoul, South Korea today. The group wants to avoid a repeat of the separate decisions on safety issues like the ones that barred the Boeing aircraft from flying earlier this year. The Boeing 737 MAX was grounded by several countries at different times soon after its second deadly crash in 5 months, one in Indonesia and the other in Ethiopia. Early reports blamed a software problem for the crashes, which took 346 lives. IATA officials say the group is concerned about differences in regulators' safety rules that could confuse passengers and cause problems for the air travel industry. In the case of the Boeing plane, the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration has resisted a decision led by China to ground the plane. Airline officials say that another incident in which such decisions are not coordinated could cause problems in operations and code sharing. However, the EU's top transport official, Violeta Bulc, told Reuters that the European Aviation Safety Agency reserved the right to carry out its own safety reviews within its own time limits. Before the latest crash, the Boeing 737 MAX was one of the world's most popular commercial passenger aircraft. But recently, many airlines have announced plans to postpone or cancel orders. The latest, Azerbaijan Airlines, said today that it plans to postpone a $1 billion contract with Boeing to buy 10 737 MAX passenger jets. Well, a report by the UN Human Rights Office finds human rights defenders, minorities, and indigenous people in Guatemala are subject to wide-scale, wanton attacks by state and non-state actors. The report, prepared with Guatemala's National Human Rights Institution, covers the period from January 2017 to April 2019. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the Rights Office in Geneva.
The UN Human Rights Office has recorded an alarming 884 attacks against human rights defenders, including 39 killings during the two-year reporting period. It says human rights defenders are subject to physical attacks, threats, intimidation, surveillance, stigmatization, and gender-based violence. The report accuses the government of misusing criminal law to silence those defending people's rights to lands, territories, and natural resources. It notes indigenous peoples, women defenders, LGBTI defenders, and journalists are among those at particular risk of abuse. In mid-June, Guatemalans will go to the poll to elect the president and Congress. UN Human Rights spokeswoman Marta Hurtado says this is a particularly precarious time for human rights defenders. She says her office has documented a number of attacks against community and indigenous leaders targeted for their political involvement.
Three political candidates and two people with declared intentions to run for office have been killed since January 2019. Impunity in relation to these crimes is persistent and rampant. Independent judges, including from high courts, and prosecutors have faced assaults, threats, reprisals, and have been stigmatized.
The report warns these attacks and abuses of people's civil rights bring into question the credibility of the electoral process. It says widespread violations will persist unless measures are taken to end the country's endemic corruption, redress the lack of land tenure, improve security and institutional weaknesses. The report recommends the government strengthen measures to prevent, protect, investigate, and prosecute crimes committed against human rights defenders. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. On his first trip since winning an election in May, Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison has traveled to the South Pacific in a move seen as an attempt to counter the growing influence of China in the region. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The Solomon Islands is one of six Pacific Island countries and by far the biggest that maintains diplomatic ties with Taiwan, not China. The Australian Prime Minister arrived in the South Pacific archipelago at a time when there's mounting pressure on the Solomon Islands government to switch its allegiance from Taipei to Beijing. Some lawmakers are reportedly anxious to exploit the economic opportunities they believe a shift would bring. 65% of all Solomon Islands exports go to China. The eight Pacific Island nations, including Fiji, that recognize Beijing, have received between them more than $1 billion in Chinese aid. But Dr. Transformer Corau, a former senior public servant in the Solomon Islands, is urging caution.
It's very easy for our politicians, who I find are fairly gullible and very easily attracted by finance and promises of money, but I think they need to think long-term.
Prime Minister Morrison's visit sends a clear message that Australia is determined to maintain its traditional influence over the South Pacific region, despite China's growing influence. Canberra is to spend $170 million over a period of decades on infrastructure. Jonathan Pryke, the Pacific Islands Program Director at the Lowy Institute, a Sydney-based think tank, believes Australia mustn't lose sight of the need to help its regional neighbours fight poverty and boost human rights.
We need to make sure that our taxpayer dollars are still achieving long-term development outcomes. And these development outcomes are as important to Australia's national interests as curbing China's influence in the region.
The Solomon Islands lie to the northeast of Australia and has a population of 660,000 people. Many rely on fishing, farming and forestry for their livelihoods. The archipelago has undeveloped mineral resources, including lead, gold and nickel. Ethnic tensions prompted Australia to lead a peacekeeping mission into the Solomon Islands in 2003 that lasted for 14 years. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The World Food Program says it has been able to distribute food to thousands of people trapped in two war zones in Yemen. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The World Food Program says it has delivered food in the rebel-held militarized zone of Neem for the first time since civil war broke out in Yemen more than 4 years ago. Neem governorate is northeast of the rebel Houthi-held capital Sana'a, close to the Saudi Arabian border. WFP spokesman Hervé Verhoosel says persistent negotiations have paid off. He says WFP and a partner organization, Islamic Relief, have distributed food to an estimated 5,000 people living near the front lines in the Neem district. He says the agencies gave out 2 months of rations at two food distribution points.
This is an important achievement for WFP, as the district has been a frontline conflict area which is very difficult to access, and that's since a long time. However, reports by NGOs working in Neem indicated some populations where hostilities are more intense had no access to the food distribution point.
In another bit of good news, Verhoosel says WFP has been able to provide humanitarian aid to vulnerable civilians around Duraimi city in Hodeidah Governorate for the first time in a year. The rebel-held port of Hodeidah is the principal entry point for vital humanitarian relief, including food, water, medicine, and medical supplies. The area has been engulfed in intense conflict between the Houthis and government-supported Saudi-led coalition forces. Verhoosel says WFP has provided a 2-month supply of food, water, hygiene kits, and dignity kits from the UN Children's Fund and UN Population Fund. He says both parties to the conflict have helped WFP gain access to the area. The United Nations calls Yemen the world's worst humanitarian crisis. It warns around 14 million people, or half the country's population, are on the brink of famine. WFP says it is distributing food to 10 million people a month. It says it hopes to boost that number to 12 million. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Well, the Circus Maximus Experience opened in Rome this week and offers visitors the chance to relive the ancient splendors of chariot racing. Sabina Castelfranco has more from Rome.
Ora ti trovi di fronte all'imponente Arco di Tito.
Now you find yourself in front of the Arch of Titus, which was possibly built in the place of a more ancient arch and dedicated in the year 81 after Christ by the Roman Senate and people to Emperor Flavius. This is just an example of what modern-day visitors will be listening to in their headsets, while at the same time, through special visors, see a virtual rendering of the majestic 20-meter Arch of Titus in Rome's Circus Maximus. Thanks to a groundbreaking project using interactive display technology, never before used in such an extended outdoor area, visitors are able to relive the life of one of Rome's undisputed landmarks. Visitors immerse themselves in history with overlapping images from the past and those of the reality of today. They are able to visualize architectural and landscape reconstructions of what life was like during all of the historical stages of the Circus Maximus. They can see the ancient Murcia Valley enriched with buildings and walk around in the circus among the shops of the time. They can visualize the circus during imperial times, the Middle Ages, and in a more modern age. The full itinerary involves 8 stops, including the valley and the origins of the circus from Julius Caesar to Trajan, the circus during the imperial age, the cavea or tiered seating arena, the Arch of Titus, the tabernae or shops, the circus during the Middle Ages and modern age, and lastly, a day at the circus for an experience of the exciting chariot race of the quadrigas with the screams of incitement of the public and the overturning of wagons. Visitors are able to enjoy similar experiences in Rome at the baths of Caracalla, the Arapacis, and the Domus Aurea. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
You've been listening to VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, John Dryden. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.